talking today with State Representative Joaquin Castro, who is running for Congress in District 20. Representative Castro, thank you for talking to me today. Why are you running for this office?
Well, you know, over the last several months, I kicked off my campaign in June, and as I've been making my way throughout San Antonio, I've often talked about my philosophy about government and what I believe in as a Democrat, and it's kind of to boil it down into, I guess, a few paragraphs. I believe in building what I call an infrastructure of opportunity in our country. And by that I mean, I think that just as there's a system of streets and roads and highways that helps all of us get to where we want to go on the road, I think that in life there's another kind of infrastructure that's an infrastructure of opportunity that helps each of us chase down our American dream. And just like streets and roads and bridges have to be built and maintained, I believe that that infrastructure of opportunity has to be built and maintained as well. So it's got to include certain things that allow people to move up the socioeconomic ladder in American society. For example, great public schools and universities, a strong and sound healthcare system, a social safety net, particularly for the elderly and the impoverished, an economy built around well-paying jobs so that people can support themselves, their family members. That is what I see as the crux of the responsibility of people in government, and not only people in government, because I don't think that government can or should do it all alone, but government working with business and with the community to continue to build out that infrastructure of opportunity. And also, Charles, I also believe that that's what distinguishes the United States of America from many of the nations in the world. If you think about it, why people have come here, why this has been a destination nation for generations now, I don't think it's because people are coming here for the lowest corporate tax rate. They're coming here because they want to be part of that system of opportunity that we've built up. So the reason I'm running for Congress is that at least in my part of the world, in San Antonio and hopefully in Texas, I'd like to be part of helping to build that.
Okay. Now, you served in the Texas legislature for 5 terms. Talk to me about what you've done in the Texas legislature and what you say would be your main accomplishments there, what you're most proud of.
I would say the thing I'm proudest of is my work in higher education. I passed an important bill on developmental education last session. Was part of the higher education committee as we funded. We created a fund to allow more universities in Texas to rise to tier one status, because we know that Texas lags behind our competitor states of New York and California. We've only got 3 tier one research universities in Texas. California has 9 and New York has 7. So certainly higher education and secondary education have been my big passions. But I've also carried legislation in juvenile justice. I had a good piece of what was known as the Parents' Bill of Rights, or what we were calling it at the time, in the Juvenile Justice Reform Bill of 2007, I believe. Carried legislation with regard to domestic violence. I worked with Planned Parenthood on legislation with respect to combating teen pregnancy. So on education and on several other issues, and also the issues that matter to San Antonio, of course, I've been there to be as helpful as I can in the legislature.
Now, it's interesting you talk about the Tier 1 universities. Just the other day, a report came out that suggested that Texas is kind of at a juncture where, you know, it kind of has to choose between pursuing more Tier 1 universities and, you know, making college accessible, affordable, and attainable. By that I mean, you know, where they can graduate for a broader array of students. Well, what did you think about that?
You're right. I mean, you see that debate going on at the University of Texas at San Antonio, for example. Until a few years ago, their admissions rate was, 90-something percent. So in order to move up to Tier 1 status, they have to become more selective in their admissions criteria. So the question is fairly asked, well, does that mean that you're shutting out a segment of the community? Fortunately, in San Antonio, there are a lot of other options for higher education degrees. For example, you know, San Antonio is the only city that's got both an A&M and a UT campus right here in our city. And so there's other options for our students. So I do see it as a concern, though. But I do think that in many parts of Texas, we've got the infrastructure, the universities in place to resolve that. Now, that said, there's still parts of Texas where the infrastructure has still not been built out, particularly around the border. for example, I mean, you probably know that you can't get a law degree anywhere south of San Antonio between here and the Mexican border. You can't get a medical degree anywhere south of San Antonio. There's still just a handful of doctoral programs in the valley. And, you know, in an area where you've got a population that's a million or more in that area. And so those are very, I think, alarming facts in Texas. So when I talk about building out the infrastructure of opportunity, in that instance, I mean literally the infrastructure of universities, the infrastructure of master's and PhDs and professional degrees. So we've still got a long way to go in Texas in building out that infrastructure in particular places.
Okay. As we talk, there's a big debate going on over, federally funded student loans. And, you know, student debt has reached, I believe, the $1 trillion mark. It's expensive to go to college these days, and yet we tell people, if you don't go to college, you can't, you know, you can't be successful in life. So what does Congress need to do to address some of these questions of student debt and you know, educational opportunity?
At least two things, two areas that we've got to focus on. You do bring up a good point, because a lot of people end up taking out debt for college, student loans, and then they don't complete college, and they're still saddled with the loan. So it's essentially the worst of both worlds. We got to really pay attention to two things. One is in secondary education, and the other is in higher education. In secondary education, we need to reform the counseling system. And the reason we need to reform that is because right now, it's our primary way of college advising, and it's an anachronism. We have in Texas a ratio of 420 students to every counselor. You think about how that compares with the guidelines for folks that are in kindergarten to third grade with teaching, where it's 22 to 1, right? You have a mandatory ratio. So essentially, we've got a system that's set up that really fails in terms of advising students about going to college, about making the best choices for themselves. And really the legislature, you know, we've kind of sounded the drumbeat, some of us in the legislature, over the last several years, going back as far as I can tell to about 1999 or 2001 when Senator Lucio carried a bill. But that issue deserves a lot of attention from both the state and the federal government. And really what we do in Texas is we assume we've spent a lot of time trying to get students college ready. But that's a description of somebody's substantive acquisition of knowledge. There's a difference between being college ready and actually going to college and setting up an infrastructure, government or school district, setting up an infrastructure of policies and personnel that actually push people onto college. That part we haven't done. So I would work on revising that. The second part I'd work on is with higher education. We know, for example, that more than 50% of Texas high school students who go on to college don't go on to four-year universities or don't start there. They start at our community colleges. Yet if you look at the completion and the transfer rates at our community colleges, they're quite abysmal. And part of the big reason for that is that many students start out in what's called developmental, or what we used to know as remedial education. And developmental education represents what I've called the graveyard in higher education. In other words, a lot of people's dreams of, you know, pursuing a degree in a certain field or having a career in a certain field literally die in developmental education. For example, a quarter of our students who graduate directly from high school going into college, about a quarter to a third of our students place in either one or more levels of developmental education. And what happens is, in San Antonio, for example, at Alamo Colleges, you can spend up to 2 years taking developmental courses for which you get no college credit, and you pay full price. And so what happens is that a lot of students get discouraged. They're often in this work-school tug-of-war where they're trying to work and go to school at the same time, and ultimately sometimes work wins out. And so reforming that developmental education process is extremely important. And over the last few years, we've had really in-depth conversations about it in the Higher Education Committee and the House of Representatives. Also, the Commissioner of Higher Education, Raymond Paredes, thankfully has taken it on as a cause to reform. But you've got to get more people through that bottleneck. And, you know, you talk about loans and debt. A lot of people end up taking out loans during that period, and they never make it through developmental ed. And so they're saddled with the debt, and they have no degree to show for it.
Okay. Let's talk about the economy. You know, things have generally been getting better. They can always can do better than they are. What sorts of legislation or policies would you pursue or support to, you know, get the economy in higher gear and keep the recovery going?
Sure. Well, you know, certainly I support the president's efforts with the infrastructure bank, for example. I support the buffer rule. I think that we need to repeal all or some of the Bush tax cuts to give the economy a shot in the arm. You know, so all of these policies, I think, that would get us back on track. Unfortunately, you've had a Congress that's been gridlocked, I believe, in large part because of a very strong Tea Party resistance in the Republican Party, really to compromising on negotiating on just about anything the president's been trying to do. And really, that's been very unhealthy for the country and unhealthy for Texas. And so, you know, I'm hoping that in the next Congress, that the elections of 2012 will sort out, you know, that battle essentially, and that folks will come to the table in 2013 much more willing to work together for the betterment of the country.
And you briefly mentioned the Buffett rule. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, inequality in the tax codes. You know, beyond the Buffett rule, what would you do to try and, you know, deal with some of that inequality, which has led to, you know, fairly unequal distribution of the wealth in America?
Sure. I mean, we know, for example, that, you know, that the concentration of wealth in the country has gone up over the last, particularly since the 1970s, for example. You know, I think you've got to have a fair tax system, you know. You don't want to discourage success, of course. You want to reward success. And you want to encourage investment by individuals and by companies. At the same time, you know, you've got to have a system that's fair to people that are earning $30,000 a year, $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year. And for that reason, I think, you know, I think that where there are corporate loopholes that we need to close, I think that we should close them, you know, and be fair to individuals who aren't making as much as somebody that may be making $1 million a year.
Okay. Let's talk immigration reform, because that's been something that's been part of the national conversation for several years without really, unfortunately, getting anywhere. What does comprehensive immigration reform look like to you?
Comprehensive immigration reform would include a path to citizenship for folks, particularly for minors who would qualify under the DREAM Act legislation. But first, I think we need to go, when we think about that debate, I think we need to go, before we talk about specific policy, I think we need to talk about the country and really the conscience of the nation. The challenge I see with immigration is that our country is still wrestling with the fact that there are somewhere between 12 and 20 million people here who are undocumented. And obviously there's a lot of negative sentiment about that. And it seems that people's unwillingness or desire for that not to be true gets in their way of reckoning with it and accepting it as a fact, and then moving on to a pragmatic solution to it. So I think what we see is that the country is still wrestling with accepting that fact, that there are three or four major American industries that are literally powered by undocumented labor. The best example of that is the agricultural industry, that by its own report, self-reporting, says that 50% of its workers are undocumented, which probably means that 75% of its workers are undocumented. And so I feel as though, you know, once all sides accept those facts for what they are, I think we can come to the table and be more pragmatic about a solution. I do think that what you've seen over the years, if you counted up all of the votes by both Republicans and Democrats, we could have passed a version of the DREAM Act. You know, it failed by about 5 votes in the Senate in the last Congress. But if you look at the stated support for it over the years, before President Obama came into office, and then after President Obama came into office, if you combine those votes, it really should have passed.
Yeah, and it actually did have a majority in the Senate, but of course, majority doesn't mean what it's supposed to mean when we're talking about
Senate. Sure, and, you know, and we know that in this period in which we've lived since President Obama has taken office, the minority party in the Senate, the Republican Party, has essentially, you know, forced the majority to get try to get 60 votes more than at any other time in history. So, I mean, they've essentially changed the rules, not in the sense that, you know, literally the rule book. I mean, you know, it's in the rules that you can require 60 votes, but they've invoked that more often than ever before.
Okay. You've talked about infrastructure quite a bit in this conversation, you know, using it somewhat metaphorically, but let's talk about actual infrastructure, roads, bridges, pipelines, internet connectivity. What do you see as being the big challenges for Congress and the solutions for dealing with a lot of the actual physical infrastructure issues we have in America?
Well, as I mentioned, I support the president's idea for the infrastructure bank. I think that we're going to have to increase funding for our infrastructure. The best example of that and where it was crystallized was several years back with the bridge in Minnesota that collapsed. And it was discovered, after an analysis that, it just had not been tended to. And unfortunately, you've got a lot of infrastructure for which that is the case. In a state like Texas, not only do you have the challenge of maintaining and preserving your existing infrastructure, but we're also one of the fastest, if not the fastest growing state in the nation, right? We were the only state that picked up 4 new congressional seats, for example. Nobody else even picked up 3. The next closest state picked up 2. So that means that you've got a plan for the growth of all of these new people in your state. And there's no way to do it unless you commit the funds, both from the state government and from the federal government, to actually building it out. Bridges, roads, streets, all of it.
All right. After the redistricting roulette wheel stopped temporarily, you wound up in District 20, which is currently held by Representative Charlie Gonzalez, who is retiring. How would you be like Representative Gonzalez when you're elected, and how would you be different from him?
Charlie, he and his dad have such an incredible legacy in South Texas and San Antonio. In fact, I've said publicly many times that there is no more honored or esteemed name in South Texas politics than Gonzalez. And so this is really historic for the city because it's the first time since 1961 that a Gonzalez, in 2013, will no longer hold a seat. I'm honored to be following that legacy. I realize that I have big shoes to fill, and Charlie's been very helpful in supporting my campaign and in also trying to give me advice about how to conduct myself, quite frankly. So in terms of what I do, certainly the Gonzalez has had an excellent reputation for their constituent services. They were both very good about responding to their constituents. But that's something that I've always tried to work on in my office, because, as you know, the Texas legislature only meets once every other year for about 5 months, which means that the job, when you're not in a legislative session, essentially becomes a job of constituent services. So certainly I would try to maintain that close connection to the people, to being very responsive and answering the call of duty in that way. In terms of what I do different, that's a good question, and I hadn't thought about it. I guess I need to go back and think about whether, I see any big differences about how I would handle myself differently than Charlie. I mean, all I can say is that people in San Antonio have been very happy with his representation, and he's held in high regard.
Okay. When the congressional map first came out, you were going to run in District 35. That stretches from San Antonio to Austin. Then there was the interim map that did away with that, and then Representative Gonzalez retired, and you were going to run for that. Now we have a different interim map that has, District 35 again. That was the result of an agreement between, primarily one of the redistricting plaintiffs, the Texas Latino Redistricting Task Force, and the Attorney General's office. Some of the other plaintiffs didn't care for that agreement. They argued that, Democrats could have gotten, right, and Latinos could have gotten more because the D.C. court still hasn't made its ruling. What's your opinion on all that? Do you agree with the settlement that led to this interim map? What changes would you like to see when the D.C. court finally gets around to ruling?
Two things. First, You know, so I voted against the Republican maps that were passed by the legislature. I don't think that they accounted for the demographic trends in the state and the population growth. Certainly, I don't think that they allotted enough seats to a very quickly growing minority population, and I think that it would have been fair to do so, and that didn't happen. So I disagree with how the legislature drew the maps, and I voted against it. In terms of the what I hope that the D.C. court does is I hope that they'll come back and redraw it. I hope that they'll do something different than what than the map we're going to run under in 2012. Unfortunately, that looks like it's going to take some time to happen. But as you may recall, in 2003, you know, I was part of a group of Killer D's, if you recall back then, that went to Oklahoma for 4 days.
I remember that well.
You know, we were trying to thwart Tom DeLay and redistricting. They finally passed the bill in 2003, and it took until about November or October of 2006 to finally remedy that. You know, and so hopefully it doesn't take as long this time, but I'm hopeful that it will change. As far as the agreement itself or what the court came up with, and, you know, I know that that some parties agreed and some parties didn't with the Attorney General. It's hard for me to second guess what they believe was in their best interest. I guess I will say that I don't know that that was not the best outcome for us. For us, I mean, those of us who feel like I do, I don't think that was the best outcome for us. At the same time, I don't know that there was a better deal to be made or a better agreement to be made. By that, I mean, you know, if we were holding out for the 35th district to go away, well, you know, the state was not going to agree to that. So if you're going to go after that, if you're planning on it, or if you're hoping for it, then you're going to have to get it through a court. And that's where we are now.
Okay. You know, I don't recall if you have a primary opponent at this point, but regardless, you're pretty much, you are pretty much a shoe-in for the election in November. And as such, the DCCC has tapped you to help raise some money for other people. Talk to me about what exactly you're going to be doing.
Sure. And you're right, I don't have a primary opponent. I do have a Republican in November, and actually I have a Green and a Libertarian candidate in November. But I have agreed to help the DCCC. I'm in what's called the majority maker category. I think there's five of us across the country. And we're candidates who are not yet elected, but, you know, we've done a pretty good job of fundraising. And so we've agreed to help candidates who are in seats that we're hoping to take from red or Republican to blue Democrat. And so, you know, I've committed to raise about $100,000 for the DCCC. I think we've contributed and raised something like $42,000 so far. And, you know, I mean, I want to see as many Democrats elected as possible, both in Texas and throughout the country.
Okay. And, I mean, you've been very publicly supportive of President Obama. I presume that at some point during the campaign, he'll probably come to visit San Antonio. What would you like to see the president talk about in San Antonio the next time he's there?
I think the president, I think he's supposed to be here in June and also in Austin in June. I think a lot of Texans would like to see that Texas matters, you know, to Washington, particularly as Democrats. There are many folks who have worked for years for the Democratic Party and feel like Texas gets ignored, in part because, quite frankly, you know, our state has been fairly Republican for a long time. In fact, we're the state that's gone the longest without electing a Democrat statewide. And so for that reason, people often feel like Texas is given up for dead as far as electing Democrats goes statewide. But I guess what I'd like to hear is the president talk about Texas and how, in the future, it can turn back to a blue state, and how we might get there.
Okay. And, you know, looking ahead to November, when people vote, you know, in the regular election, why should they vote to make you the successor to Representative Gonzalez in the 20th Congressional District and not one of your opponents?
Oh, well, that's a good question, you know. I was born and raised in the district on the west side of San Antonio, which is part of the heart of the 20th Congressional District. You know, my family, my grandmother was the first to come here on my mom's side to San Antonio almost 100 years ago, and she settled on the west side. And so my roots in the city and in this community in particular run very deep. my experiences, and then also my legislative experience, having served for 5 terms in the Texas legislature now, I've had a chance to work not only on the legislation that I mentioned before, but also work on many of the big issues that matter to San Antonio, whether it's energy issues, water issues, education, all of those things, and I think that I could be helpful in Washington as well.
Okay. Joaquin Castro, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you.